Hello, I'm Richard Kilgariff. Welcome to the Bukomi podcast, original memorable insights from the world's most wanted minds across business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode, we lock down with former Special Forces soldier Dean Stott, who served alongside Prince Harry in Afghanistan.
He didn't want any preferential treatment. You know, he wanted to be treated like everyone else. You know, if he wasn't good enough, then tell him he wasn't good enough. But he was. He was confident. He's very astute. And yeah, you then tend to forget who he was. You know, he's second Lieutenant Wales.
Dean's military career was cut short by a horrific parachuting accident. But his story doesn't end there. As soon as he could walk again, he set up a private security firm and began working for governments and companies in some of the most dangerous places on Earth.
For me, I was trying to find a niche in the industry. How do I stand out? You know, a lot of my friends were doing maritime security off the coast of Somalia. I wasn't really interested in that. So I obviously got involved with crisis management and evacuation planning.
When he realised he was about to end up, in his words, dead or divorced, Dean Stott took on a different challenge: to cycle up the world's longest road in record time. His book, Relentless, from SBS to World Record Breaker, maps his pursuit of excellence and his take on leadership when the landscape changes every day.
It's very similar to being on operations, actually. You can't foresee what's going to happen. You just need to react to the situation on the ground. The military are good at, yes, having orders, but as leaders, you need to also make decisions.
Dean Stott, you're ex-Special Forces, travel the world, you've broken a huge world record at the Pan American Highway, you've evacuated embassies, you're as comfortable underwater as you are on land, but how have the last few weeks been as a challenge to you?
Yeah, it's different. You know, we never experienced anything like this. Everyone says, are there any top tips from your time in the military? It's very different, the situation we are when we're in the military. In the military, you're there for a purpose, you have an objective, either a mission. Oh, sorry.
Can we go next door? Or should Daddy go next door?
In fact, I've been told I'm too noisy. Yeah, it's challenging. I think it's challenging for everyone, and everyone has varying levels. You know, my time in the military has put me in a great position where we are at the moment. You know, we used to go on operations or being OPs, observation posts, overwatching positions. And you could be in there anything, you know, from days up to weeks. But you're exposed to the elements as well. But the reason we're there, we had a purpose of being there, and that's what's different from this. Is the military is very very disciplined. There's a structure and there's orders and reason for you being there. For the rest of the world now, we're not used to being told what to do. We're seeing what's on TV, but so I think a lot of people are struggling until they witness firsthand how it's affecting them as individuals, be it a family member becoming ill as well. I think a lot of people aren't really taking it too serious. So maybe the government should go introduce some draconian measures which then match that military sort of style.
In terms of following orders, I mean, you've followed orders, given orders, and you've led. What do you see from a leadership point of view the government are doing right and wrong?
I think, obviously, I do feel for the government because there's no sort of template. We've never been in this position before. We can't say, well, you know, this was like, you know, such and such battle or such and such operation. So they're literally having to react to the situation on the ground. And the great thing about this is communication and information. Learn from others. You know, we're seeing what's happened in Wuhan. We're seeing what's happened in Italy. You know, what's worked for them? You know, what hasn't worked? You know, did they lockdown too early, did lockdown too late? So literally they are just going on what information they've got. And it's very similar to being on operations, actually. You can't foresee what's going to happen. You just need to react to the situation on the ground. But the military are good at, yes, having orders, but as leaders, you need to also make decisions. You know what I mean? Yes, that may have worked in the past, but will that work here and now? Or do I need to have a different approach? So that's a good thing about leaders, not being scared to do something differently.
When you're a leader, or when you are a leader who also has politics in mind, you have to be aware of the political repercussions of what's going to happen. Yes, we're in a matter of life and death situation here. You're used to existing in that environment of life and death. But in a military operation, you go forward with your decisions, but you don't have everybody after that picking it to pieces.
You're the person on the ground. You're the one seeing firsthand what's happening. Someone back in London or someone back in Washington, D.C. can't then question your decision later on because they weren't in that position. You know, I mean, you obviously have varying pressures as well. So very difficult for the government because, like I said, they, you know, they will be questioned why they decided to do that. And, you know, they don't really have anything to go on other than what other governments are doing. And if the other governments from the other countries aren't doing it right, difficult times, especially when you have, you know, certain governments or certain individuals tend to do one thing, which is absolutely outrageous. So it's just trying to find what's working and what isn't working. Depends. Unfortunately, whatever you do, you're not going to please all.
The title of your book, Relentless, From SBS to World Record Breaker, is taken from the ethos of the Special Forces, the relentless pursuit of excellence.
I joined from a young age at 17 until 33. I did 16 years there. And the ethos of Special Forces is the unrelenting pursuit of excellence. If you're going to do something, you do it to the best of your ability. And it's a great ethos, but it's not just in military sport. Could be in everything to do, be it finance, you know, literature and things like that. But I had a lot of skills from the military that I could bring to the civilian sector. You know, I hear guys saying, well, I don't have a degree, I don't have this and that. But what the military is great in doing is giving you a scenario or situation and then you having to achieve that by whatever means possible. You're having a mission. You will always have to, you will have to succeed that mission. And that's what I've done. I've just taken that sort of mindset and approach into the civilian sector and now into my challenges. I'd only cycled 20 miles when I applied for the world record, so I wasn't a cyclist, but I knew that the military set of procedures and protocol works, and the military is very good at covering all potential situation scenarios and then having, you know, a primary option, a secondary, and even a tertiary. So that's what I did. I just took that template, dropped it onto the challenge and planned it that way. I just crossed out ammunition. I didn't need ammunition for this. You can have the best plan in the world. No, the military are very good at that. We're also good at, especially in the Special Forces, we're very expeditionary. Whereas the Green Army like to be told where they're going, you know, what time, what equipment, you know, everything else. Special Forces wise, we'll get dropped into a country or a situation and we won't know what the situation is on the ground and we just need to make it happen. So there's two very different mindsets. So I took that Green Army approach in the meticulous planning, but then also was reliant on that expeditionary approach. And the situation changed so much on my challenge and I was reacting to the changes as they happened. So the start point was always the same and the objective was Alaska. The route there wasn't as straightforward. The world record was under 17 days. I was aiming for 110. And it wasn't because I wanted to smash it by a week. Should there be situations out of my control in the planning, be it natural disasters, coups in countries, third-party influence, it wasn't eating into my challenge. So the first week, I had horrendous winds. And by the end of the first week, I was 39 miles behind target. But my target was still a week ahead of the world record. After that week, the weather then changed and the winds were in my favour and it was getting a lot better. So I made sure that at the end of the day, I was on target or ahead of target. So I hear or see people doing their challenges and they send us, you know, the 10 miles behind today, but I'll catch that up tomorrow. Well, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You could have another bad day and then be 20 to 30 miles behind. So for me, I'd rather just stay on the bike longer to make sure that I'd hit my objective for that day or even better. So that going into the next day, you're in a good mindset. So that's why there was never any sort of creep in my mind that I wanted to turn back because I knew I was hitting my target point.
You prepare for the worst. You assume the worst is going to happen.
Yeah.
And therefore, you're prepared for every eventuality. So when something good happens or success happens, it's a bonus. That's not really a positive mindset, is it? That's quite pessimistic.
It's not a positive mindset, but it tricks the mind in thinking. So, for example, I'll give you the COVID-19 situation. I get the question, how long do you think we're going to be in lockdown? And, you know, the government came out 4 weeks ago and mentioned 3 weeks. A lot of people then had it then ingrained in their head. That's it. It's 3 weeks. I'd still had the end of July. So for me, I'm already getting preparing myself mentally for that, rather than after 3 weeks finding out we're in for another 3 weeks and feeling deflated. So anything better than that is a positive. And that's what it is. It's just preparing your mind or preparing yourselves for the worst, and then anything else is a bonus.
When you jumped out of a plane and almost ripped your leg off, basically.
Yeah.
That meant your military career was over and you had to think again. What did you feel like then when you were at the top of your game and then all of a sudden you hit rock bottom?
Yeah, at the time, I didn't really know it was happening. But in reflection and in the book, what I was going through was an identity crisis. And there's a lot of parallels between the special forces and professional sportsmen. You know, you spent your career building yourself up to be the best that you can be in that sport or discipline. And then all of a sudden, a life-changing injury, and everything's changed overnight. Everything you've known up until that point has changed. I watched my friends fly off to Afghanistan as I then entered a world of the civilian street. And for me, it was, I had a purpose, I had a role. I was working in a tight-knit team, like-minded individuals. How do I now fit in society? What is my role or purpose within this community, which is the rest of the world? And I was guilty of it at the start, of blaming the civilian sector, saying that they didn't understand me, they didn't understand my mindset and the way I work. And actually now, again, in reflection, when I speak to a lot of the military guys, is that, you know, we're the unique ones. We're the ones that are different, and we need to fit into that society, not the other way around. And I think that's where some people get it mixed up. And that's where I was having confusion at the beginning. But thankfully, my wife, Alana, as you know, very entrepreneurial, she sort of kept me on the right path and was teaching me, you know, things we take for granted in the military. They're like your mother, your father. They clothe you, they feed you, they pay you on time. You know, they sort out the heating supply, they sort out the council tax ban. We don't deal with any of that. And it's actually those sort of basic knowledge that I was lacking when I got out. Who do I speak to about, you know, council tax ban and things like that? So difficult times can be turbulent or could be quite smooth. And mine was very smooth because of Alana, but I hear horror stories of other service leavers going through that turbulent process.
While you were in Afghanistan, you made friends with, you served alongside Prince Harry, didn't you?
Yeah, so him and I were on a training course in 2007, actually, just before his first tour of Afghanistan. It was a forward air controllers course, a 6-week course where basically you, the controller on the ground, are talking to the pilots, need air support. And so, yeah, so prior to his first tour, he was on that course, and him and I then got partnered off for the 6 weeks, so got quite close.
You went to his wedding with Meghan. Well, you just finished the world record for the Pan American, hadn't you? And you flew back.
Yeah, well, that was it.
Were you still in your Lycra?
No, but I'd lost 12 kilos in weight, and the morning suit was, it wasn't hanging off me. I'd given Alana some new measurements 2 weeks before. So I wasn't actually aware of the royal wedding until day 70. I got into North America on day 70, and I was 14 days ahead of my target. And I thought, perfect. I know I can take a day's rest. Alana rang me and told me that we'd been kindly invited to this royal wedding, which was great. It was nice to be invited, but mentally going into that phone call, I was 14 days ahead of the world record. 10 minutes later, I'm one day behind. So when I talk about reacting to change on the ground, that was probably one of my biggest curveballs, was that I then needed to cycle even faster. All that effort I'd done for 70 days had just been taken from me, and I was now behind target. But a great motivator going forward. What a great motivator, you know, keep going faster because, you know, you've got this huge event when you get back.
What's it like serving alongside someone as famous as that?
Harry in the military was probably, he was at his most comfortable because whatever decision he did, whatever he was doing, it wasn't being scrutinized. It wasn't in the papers. He could be a man amongst men. He had a job. He had a purpose. You know, he was an officer, so he had those serving beneath him, so he had to be making the right decisions, but he was also beneath other officers as well, so he understood the structure. So yeah, he was at his most comfortable. The first thing I noticed with Harry was the fact that he didn't want any preferential treatment. You know, he wanted to be treated like everyone else. You know, if he wasn't good enough, then tell him he wasn't good enough. And but he was confident. He's very astute. And yeah, you then tend to forget who he was. You know, he's left second Lieutenant Wales, and I was Sergeant Stott, and that was it. I was on course with him. I wasn't actually teaching him, which was good as well. So I was learning with him as we went along. So we had that that common ground there as well.
You share that experience of leaving military service and being faced with a civilian life. I mean, he's done it doubly, hasn't he? He's gone from military to royal, and now he's gone for sort of his high profile, but civilian. Do you think that he will fall back on what he learned in the military to get himself into a new gear in life, you know, into a new channel in life? I mean, because he's obviously got a strong partner, as you have.
Yeah.
Does that help, obviously?
I think it does. I think his time in the military is set him aside from, you know, some of the other members of the royal family. You know, I was at an event a few weeks about the Endeavour Fund. He said, you know, that is his family. You know, the military is his family. Once you're in the military, you never leave the military. That's one of the things. You're always in the military, in that community. But there's a lot of skill sets. You know, it's probably grown in confidence. You know, he's probably before that was being told where to go, what to do. And actually, right now you're now a leader of men. You're going to fly a helicopter. You know, that's built his confidence up in himself. And he's probably taken that away and sort of now introduced that into his new life. And obviously, lots changed as well in the last 2 years. He's now married. He's now a young father. So his priorities have changed as well. You know, I mean, he just wants to protect them and go on a different path.
Well, you and he, if you can call it luck, have been lucky in that you've found a different path. But it's not always the case, is it? If you go from extreme circumstances. You went into the private security sector, which had its own extremes and its own challenges. And you got, is addicted the right word? You got addicted to the extremes and the dangers and the challenges faced by operations and briefs, which were taking you into very dangerous situations.
For me, I was trying to find a niche in the industry. How do I stand out? You know what I mean? A lot of my friends were doing maritime security off the coast of Somalia. I wasn't really interested in that. So I obviously got involved with crisis management and evacuation planning, you know, evacuating embassies across borders, you know, bought 30 weapons on the black market and buried them between Tunis and Egypt. And it was actually chapter 16 in the book, Dead or Divorced, when I came home from the Canadian embassy one. And Alana and I sat down and had dinner, and the pin had then dropped. I was trying to match the adrenaline rush that I had when I was still in the Special Forces, which is fine because you can do that, but you can do that in skydiving, surfing, everything like that. But I didn't have that support network around me. You know, yes, it was a success evacuating these embassies and oil companies, but what if it had gone wrong? You know, I wouldn't have that team around me. I wouldn't have Her Majesty's government flying in with guys jumping out of the sky. So yeah, something had to change. My plans worked and they did work. But it was a grounding moment that, you know, you can't do this anymore. You're no longer in that community. I'd spent 21 days that year in a 365-day calendar at home. The rest of the time was abroad. I disconnected from society. I was on my own working in Somalia, in Yemen. You know, it was almost a throwaway comment that I evacuated the embassy. For me, it was the norm, and it wasn't normal. Even to my friends who were still in the Special Forces, that isn't normal what you're doing. So I think because I was succeeding, you know, anything for me was a challenge. And every time I kept succeeding, I neglected the dangers that were on myself. Thankfully, you know, it's a strange world, because you've gone from being probably the bravest men in the world to the biggest coward. Because it's all about observation. You know, I used to hear stories about security teams in Iraq and Afghanistan getting into firefights. That's poor planning, or they've not foreseen the threats or dangers. So actually, a good security operator identifies those potential threats and dangers and goes around it. You know, 25%, I'd say, of Special Forces is offensive action. It's that thing, that sexy stuff you see on telly, you know, abseiling down buildings and rescuing hostages. Actually, 50% of what we do is support and influence hearts and minds, being embedded with local tribes and Bedouins in these countries, and understanding, you know, the actual situation on the ground, not what you're seeing on TV. You know, what is the picture on the ground? And, you know, being sympathetic as well. You know, I was going into Somalia on my own, sitting down, having with the family on the floor, you know, understanding the actual picture on the ground, the atmospherics, rather than what I'm seeing on TV. And they would then appreciate that you, as you know, we used to call as white eyes, you as white eyes have come in, you've taken that risk. And I think that was the success of this. And with the, back to the Canadian embassy evacuation, it was understanding that there's 164 tribes in Libya. You know, who are the tribal influences? Who are the tribal elders in those regions that we're going through? And it was actually all about communication. You know, thankfully, I've never had to get into any altercations since leaving the military. It's all been through, as you mentioned, observing and communicating to the right people. Yeah.
Have you always got your eye on the door?
A bit of both. When I left, Alana was a bank manager. She used to run three Santander banks. And Alana did the close protection course, the maritime security course, did the surveillance course. So she's now trained in all these aspects as well. So we find it really difficult when we go out to switch off, because I'm watching her back and she's watching mine. And the only time I really relax is when I'm with my former friends from my old unit, because then you know you're comfortable that should something go wrong, that you know we've all got each other's backs. And I think they all think the same of us, and before you know it, we're all in a mess and no one's actually got anyone's back. But I do struggle to switch off. I'm most relaxed probably when I'm at home, but when I'm on actual jobs, you don't relax at all. I don't realize the pressures on you until you actually come back. I mean, I sleep for almost like 48 hours. So Alana just lets me sleep because of that pressure on yourself.
You were just about to start, and maybe you still are, training for the big canoe trip down the Nile. How are you finding your physical and mental well-being when you can't really train?
Just staying physically active, you know, finding time for yourself to do some training. So Alana and I, she'll know that I've got the turbo trainer on the balcony, so I will go give myself some time. Yes, it's not the best training for kayaking, but it is something. Going out for a walk and some fresh air. So actually, I'm actually getting more training in now than I was before, as in CV training and you know, I've got the pull-up bar in the bedroom. But what we've got around the house, we have post-it notes at various points in the house. Every time you walk past, you probably do five star jumps or five burpees. So subconsciously, you're actually training without setting aside any time for it. But being physically active, if I stopped doing physical activity altogether, then I'd probably see an imbalance in my mental health. But because I'm still being active, then yes, it's not an issue at the moment.
We've all become new kinds of leaders. You know, we were talking about leaders in politics. You know, our true colours will be coming out. And, you know, we've met your son today online. My daughter's just walked in to get a printing. Yeah. We're having to redefine who we are as parents and leaders, aren't we?
We are.
From Relentless and from your experience, having led the best and been led by the best, what are the insights from your book?
I'd probably say, you know, from my experience in the military, I used to always look up to my leaders. And, you know, I was an instructor on the commando course, and I remember seeing there was two instructors with me, and they used to scream and shout at the students every morning. And you could see it in you could see the reaction from the students. They had no respect for them. They weren't getting the best out of their students at the time. Whereas I would come out, you know, have a little joke. I was approachable, you know, and that's the thing. I think you need to be approachable and relate to them. You know what I mean? I've been in that situation. They've been as well, you know. And I got more from my students doing that. And actually, they said at the end of the course, they were more worried actually about me than the other two instructors, because they knew if they upset me, it was more personal. So, you know, not being, as a leader, not being scared to change a plan, just because those before you or others are doing it that way, doesn't mean it's the right way. You know, don't be scared to change a plan and do it your way.
Good luck with the next few months. I don't think you're getting in a canoe anytime soon, are you?
No, I think the plan's still to do the Nile. The timelines on the Nile will all depend on what the world looks like when we come out of this situation. You know, I think 2 weeks ago I saw that there was only 4 cases of coronavirus in Africa. So there's clearly, you know, we're not getting much information back from that region. So I'll see what's happening in Africa when we leave, and we'll sort of gauge it from there. But it's still very much going to be happening. It's just when.
Well, I'll leave you with a pearl of wisdom that my mum shared with me when I was probably Tommy's age. And it's this. It's Love many, trust few, always paddle your own canoe.
Oh, I know it very well. We've got the T-shirts in the SBS.
You haven't?
We have, yeah. Yeah. No. It's one of the first things you buy when you get your little frog T-shirt. I mean, there's one that's got like almost a Guinness pint in the background. It says, love many, trust few, always paddle your own canoe, yeah.
Dean, lovely speaking to you.
Thank you, mate.
Dean Stott's book, Relentless, from SBS to World Record Breaker, is out now, and there's a link to buy it on our podcast page at bokomi.com. You can also sign up to our monthly Most Wanted email there, and client members can access our author intelligence service, connecting them to brilliant people like Dean for co-hosted podcasts, virtual roundtables, meetings, and events. And if you enjoyed this Bokomi podcast, please like, share, subscribe, celebrate, review, tag. It makes a big difference to everyone involved. Bye for now.